Chapter 3. Randall Cove was a very big man, endowed with great physical strength and also remarkable street instincts that he had further honed over many years of working them. He was an FBI undercover agent and had been one for nearly 17 years. He had infiltrated Latino drug gangs in L.A., Hispanic crews on the Tex-Mex border, and heavyweight Europeans in South Florida. Most of his missions had been startling and at times nail-biting successes. He was currently armed with a .40 semi-automatic, chambering hollow points that would collapse to small pancakes when they entered a body, wreaking internal havoc and probably death. He also had a sheathed knife with a serrated edge that he could use to slash vital arteries in a blur. He always prided himself on being professional and reliable in his work. Right now, some ignorant people would condemn him as a vicious criminal who should be locked up for life, or better yet, executed for his terrible sins. Cove knew he was in serious trouble, and he also realized he was the only one who could get himself out of it. Cove crouched low in the car and watched as the group of men climbed in their vehicles and headed out. As soon as they passed, Cove rose, waited a bit, and then followed them. He pulled his ski cap tighter over his newly shorn head, the dreadlocks all gone, and about time, too, he had decided. The car stopped up ahead, and Cove did, too. When he saw the group of men emerge from the vehicles, Cove pulled a camera from his backpack and clicked away. He put away the Nikon, pulled out a pair of night binoculars, and adjusted the distance magnifier. Cove nodded to himself as he tallied the men one by one. He inhaled and let go of one last deep breath and took a fast-forward reel on his life thus far as the group disappeared into a building. In college, Cove had been a bigger, faster version of Walter Payton, a consensus All-American from Oklahoma. Every NFL team was throwing bales of cash and other perks at him. They were, that is, until a ruptured ACL in both knees during a freakish spill at the scouting combine had reduced him from a supernatural guaranteed number one pick to a man with merely normal abilities who no longer excited NFL coaches. Millions of potential dollars had disappeared instantly, and the only way of life he had ever known had vanished along with them. He had moped for a couple of years, looking for excuses and pity, and his life had spiraled downward until it had nowhere else to go, and then he had found her. His wife had been a divine intervention, he had always believed, saving his miserable, self-pitying carcass from oblivion. With her help, he had straightened himself out and fulfilled a secret dream of his to be a real-life G-man. He had bounced here and there in the Bureau. It was a time when opportunities for black men were still severely limited. Cove had found himself pushed toward drug undercover work because his superiors had bluntly informed him that most of the bad dudes were people of his color. "You can walk the walk and talk the talk, and you look the part, too," they had said. And he couldn't argue with that, really. The work was dangerous enough to never be boring. Randall Cove had never easily tolerated being bored. And he put away more crooks in a month than most agents put away in their entire careers. And these were big fish, the planners, the true moneymakers, not the nickel-and-dime streetwalkers one bad snort from a pauper's grave. He and his wife had had two beautiful children, and he was thinking seriously of calling it a career when the bottom had dropped out of his world and he no longer had a wife or kids. He snapped back as the men came out, climbed in the cars, drove off, and Cove once more followed. Cove had lost something else that he could never get back. Six men had died because he had messed up badly. Been snookered like the most green agent there was. His pride was hurt, and his anger was molten. And the seventh member of the shattered team deeply intrigued Cove. The man had survived when he should have been dead too, and apparently nobody knew why, though it was early in the game yet. Cove wanted to look the man in the eye and say, "How come you're still breathing?" He didn't have Webb London's file, and he didn't see himself getting it anytime soon. Yeah, Cove was FBI, but yeah, everyone was no doubt thinking he had turned traitor. Undercover agents were supposed to live right next to the edge, weren't they? They were supposedly all head cases, right? What a thankless job he'd been doing all these years. But that was okay, because he had done it for himself, nobody else. The cars pulled into the long drive and Cove stopped, took some more pictures, and then turned around. That was apparently it for tonight. He headed back to the only place he could be safe right now, and it wasn't home. As he rounded a curve and sped up, a pair of headlights seemed to appear out of nowhere and settled in behind him. That wasn't good, not on a road like this. Attention from his fellow man was not something Cove ever sought or encouraged. He turned, so did the car. Okay, this was serious. He sped up again, so did the tail. Cove reached down to his belt holster, pulled out his pistol, and made sure the safety was off. He glanced in the rearview mirror to see if he could tell how many folks he was dealing with. It was too dark for that, no streetlights out this way. The first bullet blew out his right rear tire, the second bullet his left rear. As he fought to keep control of the car, a truck pulled out from a side road and hit him broadside. If his window had been up, Cove's head would have gone right through it. The truck had a snowplow on its front end, though it was not wintertime. The truck accelerated, and Cove's car was pushed in front of it. He felt his car about to roll, and then the truck pushed his sedan over a guardrail that had been placed there principally to protect vehicles from plummeting down the steep slope that the curve of road was built around. The car's side smashed into the dirt and then rolled, both doors popping open as the sedan continued its cartwheeling, finally landing in a heap at the rocky bottom of the slope and bursting into flames. The car that had tailed Cove stopped, and one man got out, ran to the twisted guardrail, and looked down. He saw the fire, witnessed the explosion as fuel vapor met flames, and then ran back to his car. The two vehicles kicked up gravel, leaving the scene. As they did, Randall Cove slowly rose from the spot where he'd been thrown when the driver's door had been ripped open by the first impact with the ground. He had lost his gun, and it felt like a couple of ribs were cracked, but he was alive. He looked down at what was left of his car, and then back up at where the men who had tried to kill him had raced off. Cove stood on shaky legs and started slowly making his way back up. Webb clutched his wounded hand even as his head seemed primed to explode. It was like he had taken three quick slugs of straight tequila and was about to reflux them. The hospital room was empty. There was an armed man outside to make sure nothing happened to Webb. Nothing else, anyway. Webb had been lying here all day and into the night, thinking about what had happened, and he was no closer to any answers than when they first brought him here. Webb's commander had already been in, along with several members of Hotel and some of the snipers from Whiskey and X-Ray. They had said little, all of them reeling in their personal agony, their disbelief that something like this could have happened to them. And in their eyes, Webb could sense their suspicions, the issue of what had happened to him out there. "I'm sorry, Debbie," Webb said to the image of Teddy Reiner's widow. He said the same to Cindy Plummer, Cal's wife and also now a widow. He went down the list, 6 women in all friends of his. Their men were his partners, his comrades. Webb felt as bereaved as any of the ladies. He let go of his injured hand and touched the metal side of the bed with it. What a sorry wound to bring back with him. He hadn't taken one round directly. "Not one damn shot did I get off in time," he said to the wall. "Not one. Do you realize how unbelievable that is?" he called out to the IV stand before falling silent again.
We're going to get them, Webb.
The voice startled Webb, for he had heard no one enter the room. But of course, a voice came with a body. Webb inched up on his bed until he saw the outline of the man there. Percy Bates sat down in a chair next to Webb. The man studied the linoleum floor as though it were a map that would guide him to a place that held all the answers. It was said that Percy Bates had not changed a jot in 25 years. The man hadn't gained or lost a pound on his trim 5'10 frame. His hair was charcoal black without creep of white and was combed the same way as when he first walked into the FBI fresh from the academy. It was as though he had been flash frozen, and this was remarkable in a line of work that tended to age people well ahead of their time. He had become a legend of sorts at the Bureau. He had wreaked havoc on drug operations at the Tex-Mex border and then gone on to raise hell on the West Coast in the L.A. field office. He had risen through the ranks quickly and was currently one of the top people at the Washington field office, or WFO, as it was called. He had experience in all the major Bureau divisions, and the man knew how all the pieces fit together. Bates, who went by Purse, was usually soft-spoken. Yet the man could crumple a subordinate with a look that made one feel unworthy to be occupying a square foot of space. He could either be your best ally or your worst enemy. Maybe that's how a man turned out after growing up with a name like Percy. Webb had been on the end of some of the classic Bates tirades before, when he had been under the man's direct command in his previous professional life at the Bureau. A good deal of the abuse had been deserved, as Webb had made mistakes as he learned to be a good agent. Yet Bates did play favorites from time to time, and, like everyone else, sometimes went searching for scapegoats to pin blame upon when things went to hell. Thus, Webb did not accept the man's statements right now at face value. Nor did he accept the subdued tone as a token of peace and goodwill. Yet the night Webb had lost half his face in the fury of combat, Bates had been one of the first people by his bedside, and Webb had never forgotten that. No, Percy Bates was not a simple equation, not that any of them were. He and Bates would never be drinking buddies, yet Webb had never believed one had to do shooters with a guy to respect him.
I know you've given us the prelims, but we'll need your full statement as soon as you're able, said Bates. But don't rush it. Take your time. Get your strength back.
The message was clear. What had happened had crushed them all. There would be no outbursts from Bates, at least not right now.
More scratches than anything, Webb mumbled in response. They said a gunshot wound to your hand. Cuts and bruises all over your body. The docs said it looked like somebody had taken a baseball bat to you.
Nothing, Webb replied, and then felt exhausted by saying the word.
You still need to rest, and then we'll get your statement.
Bates rose.
And if you're up to it, and I know it'll be hard, it would help if you could go back down there and run us through exactly what happened.
And how I managed to survive? Webb nodded. I'll be ready sooner than later.
Don't rush it, Bates said again. This one ain't going to be easy, but we'll get it done.
He patted Webb on the shoulder and turned to the door. Webb stirred, trying to sit up.
Purse?
In the darkness, the whites of Bates's eyes were really the only things visible of him. To Webb, they were like a pair of dice hanging, showing deuces somehow.
They're all dead, aren't they? All of them, Bates confirmed. You're the only one left, Webb.
I did all I could. The door opened and then closed, and Webb was alone. Outside in the hallway, Bates conferred with a group of men dressed exactly as he was. Nondescript blue suit, button-down shirt, muted tie, rubber-soled black shoes and big pistols in small-clip holsters.
This will be a media nightmare, you know that, said one of them. It already is, in fact.
Bates stuck a piece of gum in his mouth, substitute for the Winstons he had given up for the fifth time now and counting. "The needs of suckwad journalists are not high on my priority list," he said.
"You have to keep them informed, Purse. If you don't, they'll assume the worst and start making it up. There's already been stuff on the internet you wouldn't believe, that this massacre is tied to either the apocalyptic return of Jesus or something to do with a Chinese trade conspiracy. I mean, where do they get this crap? It's driving the media relations people nuts."
"I can't believe anybody would have the guts to do this to us," said another man, who had grown gray and plump in the service of his country. Bates knew this particular agent had not seen anything other than the top of his government desk in more than a decade, but liked to act as though he had.
"Not the Colombians, the Chinese, or even the Russians could have the guts to attack us like that."
Bates glanced at the man.
"It's us against them, remember? We try to cram it down their throats all the time. You think they don't want to return the favor?"
"Well, my God, Purse, think about it. They just slaughtered a squad of our men on our home turf," the old fellow blustered indignantly.
Purse looked at him and saw an elephant without tusks, just about ready to drop and die and become dinner for the jungle carnivores.
"I didn't realize we had laid claim to that part of D.C., said Bates.
He had last slept the day before yesterday and was now really starting to feel it.
"In fact, I was under the impression that that was their home turf and we were the visiting team."
"You know what I mean. What could have prompted this sort of attack?"
"Shit, I don't know. Maybe because we try so damn hard to pull the plug on their $1 billion a day drug pipeline, and it's starting to really piss them off, you idiot."
As he said this, Bates backed the man into a corner and then decided the guy was far too harmless to be worth a suspension.
"How's he doing?" asked another man, with blonde hair and a nose red from the flu.
Bates leaned against the wall, chewed his gum, and then shrugged.
"I think it's messed more with his mind than anything else, but that's to be expected."
"One lucky guy is all I can say," commented Red Nose. "How he survived it is anyone's guess."
It took barely a second for Bates to get in this man's face. He was obviously taking no prisoners tonight.
"You call it luck to watch six of your team get ripped right in front of you? Is that what the hell you're saying, you dumb son of a bitch?"
"Geez, I didn't mean it like that, Purse. You know I didn't."
Red Nose coughed a good one, as though to let Bates know he was sick and in no shape to fight. Bates moved away from Red Nose, thoroughly disgusted with them all.
"Right now, I don't know anything. No, I take that back. I know that Webb single-handedly took out 8 machine gun nests and saved another squad and some ghetto kid in the process. That I do know. The preliminary report says Webb froze." This came from another man who had joined their ranks, yet he was one who clearly stood above them all.
2 stone-faced gents were in lockstep behind the intruder.
"And actually, Purse, what we know is only what Webb has told us," said the man.
Though this person was obviously Percy Bates's superior in official rank, it was equally apparent that Bates wanted to bite his head off, yet didn't dare. The man continued,
"London's got a hell of a lot of explaining to do, and we're going into this investigation with our eyes wide open, a lot more wide open than last night. Last night was a disgrace. Last night will never, ever happen again. Not on my watch."
He stared hard at Bates and then said, with sarcasm driven home with a sledgehammer,
"Give London my best."
With that, Buck Winters, head of the FBI's Washington field office, stalked off, followed by his 2 robotic escorts. Bates gazed with loathing at the man's back. Buck Winters had been one of the principal frontline supervisors at Waco and had, in Bates' opinion, contributed to the eventual carnage with his ineptness. Then, in the funny way of big organizations, Winters had received promotion after promotion for his incompetence until he had reached the top of WFO. Maybe the Bureau was just unwilling to admit it had messed up and believed that promoting from the ranks of the leadership of the Waco fiasco was a strong message to the world that the Bureau considered itself blameless. Eventually, many heads had rolled because of the flame-out of David Koresh in Texas, but Buck Winters' head was still firmly attached to his shoulders. For Percy Bates, Buck Winters represented much that was wrong with the FBI. Bates leaned against the wall, crossed his arms, and chewed his Wrigley's so hard his teeth hurt. He was certain that old Buck would be running off to confer with the FBI director, the attorney general, probably even the president. Well, let him, so long as they all kept out of Percy Bates's way. The group of men slithered away singly and in pairs until just Bates and the uniformed guard remained. Finally, Bates moved off too, hands in his pockets, gaze fixed on nothing. On the way out, he spit his gum into the trash can. "Assholes and idiots," he said. "Assholes and idiots." Chapter 4. Webb, dressed in a set of blue surgery scrubs, carried a bag with his personal belongings and stared at the sunlit sky that filled the window of his hospital room. The layers of gauze around his wounded hand were irritating. He felt like he was wearing a boxing glove. He was about to open the door to leave when it opened all by itself. At least, that's what Webb thought, until the man appeared there. "What are you doing here, Romano?" said Webb in surprise. The man didn't acknowledge Webb right away. He was just under 6 feet tall, about 180, very powerful looking in a wiry way. He had dark wavy hair and wore an old leather jacket, a Yankees baseball cap, and jeans. His FBI shield was pinned to his belt. The grip of a pistol poked out from its clip holster. Romano looked Webb up and down until his gaze came to rest on the man's bandaged hand. He pointed at it. "Is that it? Is that your damn wound?" Webb looked at his hand and then back at Romano. "Would it make you happier if the hole was in my head?" Paul Romano was an assaulter assigned to hotel team. He was one very intimidating guy among many such folks, and you always knew where you stood with the man, which was usually nowhere good. He and Webb had never been close, principally, Webb thought, because Webb had been shot up more than he had, and Romano strongly resented the perception that Webb was more heroic or tougher. "I'm only going to ask you this once, Webb. And I want it straight, man. You bullshit me, and I'll pop you myself." Webb looked down at the guy and stepped a bit closer so that his height advantage was even more evident. He knew this ticked off Romano, too. "Gee, Paulie, did you bring me some candy and flowers, too?" "Just give it to me straight, Webb." He paused and then asked, "Did you wimp out?" "Yeah, Paulie, those guns somehow shot themselves all up." "I know about that. I meant before that. When Charlie team went down, you weren't with them. Why?" Webb felt his face growing warm and he hated himself for it. Romano usually couldn't get to him. Yet the truth was, Webb didn't know what to tell the man. "Something happened, Paulie, in my head. I don't know exactly what. But I didn't have anything to do with the ambush, in case you suddenly lost your mind and were thinking that." Romano shook his head. "I wasn't thinking you turned traitor, Webb, just that you turned chicken shit." "If that's all you came to tell me, then you can go on and get the hell out now." Romano looked him up and down again, and Webb felt like less and less of a man with each pronounced glare. Without a word, Romano turned and left. Webb would have preferred the man had exited on the heel of another insult rather than silence. Webb waited another few minutes and then opened the door. "What are you doing up?" asked the surprised guard. "Docs discharged me, didn't they tell you?" "Nobody told me anything like that." Webb held up his bandaged hand.
Government isn't paying for another night on account of a scratched hand, and damn if I'm paying the difference on my paycheck.
Webb didn't know the guard, but he seemed like the type to be sympathetic to such a common-sense plea. Webb didn't wait to get an answer, but just walked off. He knew the guard had no grounds to stop him. All he would do was communicate this development to his superiors, which he was assuredly doing right now. Webb ducked out a side exit, found a phone, called a buddy, and an hour later he was inside his split-level 30-year-old rancher in a quiet Woodbridge, Virginia suburb. He changed into jeans, loafers, and a navy blue sweatshirt, ripped off the gauze and replaced it with a single Band-Aid of blazing symbolism. He wanted no pity from anyone, not with six of his closest friends right now lying in the morgue. He checked his messages. There weren't any of importance, yet he knew that would change. He unlocked a firebox, pulled out his spare 9mm, and thrust it into his belt holster. Although he had not technically shot anyone, this was still an SRB, or shooting review board, matter now, since Webb had most definitely fired his weapons. They had confiscated his guns, which was akin to taking his hands. Next, they had advised him of his rights, and he had given them a statement. It was all standard, by-the-books practice, and yet it still made him feel like a criminal. Well, he wasn't about to walk around without hardware. He was paranoid by nature, and the massacre of his team had made him a walking schizoid, capable of seeing real threats in babies and bunnies. He went out to the garage, cranked up his 1978 coal-black Ford Mach 1, and headed out. Webb had two vehicles, the Mach and an ancient and iron-gutted Suburban that had carried him and his Charlie team to many Redskin football games, to the beaches in Virginia and Maryland, to beer-drinking outings, and on assorted other manly campaigns up and down the East Coast. Each guy had had his own assigned seat in the Suburban based on seniority and ability, which was the way everything was divvied up where Webb worked. What outstanding times they had had in the big machine. Now Webb wondered how much cash he could get for the Suburban because he didn't see himself driving the beast anymore. He jumped on Interstate 95, headed north, and fought through the obstacle course that was the Springfield Interchange, which apparently had been designed by a highway engineer strung out on cocaine. Now that it was undergoing a major overhaul scheduled to last at least 10 years, the driver navigating it each day had the option of laughing or crying as years of his life slipped by while the traffic's progress was measured in inches. Webb sailed over the 14th Street Bridge, cleared the Northwest Quadrant where all the major monuments and tourist dollars were kept, and was quickly in a not-so-nice part of town. Webb was an FBI special agent, but he did not see himself as such. First and foremost, he was a hostage rescue team, HRT, operator, the Bureau's elite crisis response group. He didn't dress in suits. He didn't spend much time with fellow agents outside HRT. He didn't arrive on the crime scene after all the bullets had stopped flying. He was usually there from the get-go, running, dodging, firing, wounding, and occasionally killing. There were only 50 HRT operators because the selection process was so grueling. The average time at HRT was 5 years. Webb had bucked that trend and was going on his 8th year of duty. It seemed that HRT was being called upon a lot more often these days and to hot spots all over the world, with HRT's unwritten policy of being wheels up in 4 hours from Andrews Air Force Base. Well, the curtain had fallen on his part of that show. Webb was teamless now. It had never occurred to Webb that he would be the sole survivor of anything. It just didn't seem in his nature. They all had joked about it, even had morbid betting pools on who would die one moonless night. Webb had almost always been first on the list, because he always seemed to be first in the line of fire. Now it was torturing Webb, though, not knowing what had gotten between him and the seventh coffin, and the only thing worse than the guilt was the shame. He pulled the Mach to the curb and got out at the barricade. He showed his ID to the men posted there, who were all stunned to see him. Webb ducked down the alley before the army of reporters could glom onto him. They had been reporting live here since the massacre from their tall-mast satellite broadcast trucks. Webb had caught some of the news from the hospital. They were feeding the public the same facts over and over, using their little charts and pictures and sporting their little dour expressions and saying things like, "That's all we know right now, but stay with us. I'm certain we'll have more later, even if we have to make the shit up. Back to you, Sue." Webb jogged down the alley. Last night's storm had long since blown itself into the Atlantic. The air pushing behind it was cooler than the city had had in a while. Built on a swamp, Washington, D.C. handled heat and humidity better than cold and snow. When the snow fell, the only street likely to be cleared was the one in your dreams. He ran into Bates halfway down the alley.
"What in the hell are you doing here?" Bates said.
"You said you wanted my take on things, so I'm here to give it to you." Bates glanced at Webb's hand. "Let's get going, Purse. Every minute counts."
From the exact spot where the Chevy had dropped them off, Webb retraced the steps of his squad. With every stride Webb took toward the target, he could feel both his anger and his fear swell. The bodies were gone, the blood was not. Even the hard rain apparently was incapable of clearing it all away. In his mind, Webb blitzed through every move he had made, every emotion he had felt. The ruined machine gun nests were being dismantled and examined by a team of people who consistently pulled legal convictions out of microscopic scraps. Others walked the square courtyard kneeling, stooping, tagging things, probing and basically looking for answers from objects that did not appear willing to give any. Watching them, Webb was not confident. It was highly unlikely that crystal-clear tented arches and plain whorls were just waiting around on the guns to be plucked by the fingerprint techs. Whoever had planned this intricate ambush wouldn't be that careless. He stepped between the bloodstains like he was tiptoeing around a graveyard. And wasn't he really?
Windows were painted black so the guns couldn't be spotted until they started firing. "No light reflections off barrels, no nothing," said Bates.
"Nice to know we were done in by professionals," replied Webb bitterly.
"You did a number on the 50s.
Bates pointed to one of the ruined weapons.
"An SR-75 will do that for you."
"They're miniguns, military design. Six-barrel Gatling style, tripod-mounted with the pods bolted to the floor so the firing position wouldn't deviate. There were feeder box and conveyor belt attachments and 4,000 linked rounds per gun. Firing rates were set at 400 a minute, though its maximum setting is 8,000.
400 was plenty, and there were 8 guns. That's 3,200 slugs flying at you every 60 seconds. I know, because all except one ricochet missed me by a few inches.
With that low firing rate, those guns could shoot a long time.
They did.
Power drive was electric, and they were chambering armor-piercing rounds.
Webb just shook his head. Did you find what tripped them?
Bates led him over to a brick wall on the side farthest from the alley Webb had come down. It was part of the building perpendicularly placed to the targeted abandoned tenement house, and the source of one half of the firing arc that had wiped out Charlie, save Webb. What was invisible in the dark was only a bit more apparent in the daylight. Webb knelt down and looked at what he recognized as a laser device. A small hole had been punched in the brick, and the laser point and power pack inserted into it. The hole was deeper than the power pack, so that once inside the hole, it was pretty much invisible. The snipers wouldn't have been able to ID it from where they had their posts set up, even if they had been looking for such a thing. and their intelligence had given them no indication of it, as far as Webb knew. The path of the laser was knee-height, and the invisible light stream no doubt had run across the courtyard when activated.
Beam breaks, firing starts, and doesn't stop except for a few seconds pause after each cycle until the ammo's gone.
He looked around in bewilderment.
What if a dog or cat or somebody just strolling by here tripped the laser before we got there?
From Bates's expression, it was clear he had already considered this possibility.
I'm thinking people were discreetly warned to stay away. Animals are another issue, so I'm thinking the laser was armed via remote.
Webb rose.
So they waited until we were just about there before activating the laser. That means the person would have to be reasonably close by.
Well, he hears you guys coming, or he gets intelligence to that effect. He waits until you've maybe turned the corner and he hits the remote and runs.
We didn't see a damn soul in the courtyard, and my thermal didn't pick up a 98.6 temp anywhere.
They could have been in the building. Hell, any one of these buildings. They point the device out one of the windows, hit the button, and they're long gone.
And the snipers and hotel saw nothing.
Bates shook his head.
Hotel's story is they saw Zip until the kid brought them your note.
At the mention of hotel, Webb thought of Paul Romano, and his spirits sank even more. Romano was probably at Quantico right now, telling everyone that Webb had turned coward and let his team die and was trying to blame it on a mental lapse.
Whiskey? X-ray? They had to see something,
Webb said, referring to the snipers on the rooftops.
They saw some things, but I'm not prepared to discuss it quite yet.
Webb's instincts told him to let that one alone.
What would the snipers say?
That they saw Webb freeze, let his team charge on without him, and then drop to the ground while his comrades in arms got obliterated?
How about the DEA? They were with Hotel, and there was a crew of them in reserve, too.
Bates and Webb looked at each other, and Bates shook his head. The FBI and DEA weren't the best of friends. The DEA, Webb had always thought, was like a little brother kicking at his older sibling's shins until Big Brother hit back, and then the little punk ran off and tattled.
Well, I guess we have to accept that until something makes us not, commented Webb.
Guess so. Were any of you wearing night vision equipment?
Webb immediately understood the logic of the question. NV goggles would have picked up on the laser, transforming it into a long, unmistakable band of light.
No. I pulled my thermal after the shooting started, but assaulters don't wear NVs. You get any source of ambient light while you're wearing them, then you're basically blind if you have to take them off and start shooting. And the snipers probably wouldn't have been using them during the assault. They screw up depth perception too much.
Bates nodded toward the gutted buildings where the guns had been set up.
The techs examined the guns. Each had a signal link box. They're thinking that there was a delay of a few seconds between when Charlie team tripped the laser and when the guns were activated in order to make sure the team was squarely in the kill zone. The courtyard and firing lanes were large enough to allow for that.
Webb suddenly felt dizzy and put his hand against the wall. It was as though he were re-experiencing the paralysis he had suffered during the doomed attack.
You should have given yourself some more time to recover, said Bates, as he slid an arm under Webb's to help support him.
I've had paper cuts worse than this.
I'm not talking about your hand.
My head's fine, too. Thanks for your concern, Webb snapped, and then relaxed. Right now, I just want to do, not think.
For the next half hour, Webb pointed out the locations and descriptions of all the persons they had passed that night, and everything else he could recall from the time Charlie left the final staging area to the moment the last bullet was fired in the courtyard.
You think any one of them could have been working with the target? Said Bates,
referring to the people Webb and company had passed in the alley.
Down here, anything's possible, replied Webb. There was obviously a leak, and it could have come anywhere along the line.
There's a lot of possibilities there, Bates said. Let's go over some.
Webb shrugged. This wasn't a 888-beep scenario, he said, a reference to the three number eights that appeared on his pager, representing a command for all HRT operators to haul butt to Quantico. Last night was selected as the target date in advance, so everybody met at HRT to get our gear and team configurations ready, and then we moved out in the Suburbans. We did the prelim staging at Buzzard Point, and then drove to the last staging area. We had a U.S. attorney available in case we needed some additional warrants issued. The snipers were already in place. They went in early, posing as HVAC rehab workers, doing a job on roof units on two of the buildings along the strike path. Assaulters did our down and dirty with the local police, just like always. After we left the last point of concealment, Teddy Reiner requested and received compromise authority because of the unfriendly logistics. We wanted to be able to shoot on the fly if we had to. We knew that hitting the place from the front and exposing ourselves to fire in the courtyard was risky, but we also thought they wouldn't expect it. Plus, the way the building was situated and configured, there weren't a lot of options. We got the green light to move to crisis site, and then we were going to execute on Tox countdown. We had one primary exterior breach point. The assault plan was to split once we were inside and hit from two points while hotel and DEA blew in from the rear, with a unit in reserve and the snipers as backup firepower and cover. Hard and fast, just like always. The two men sat on a pair of trash cans. Bates tossed his pack of gum in the trash, pulled out his cigarettes, and offered one to Webb, who declined.
The local police knew the target, didn't they? Bates asked.
Webb nodded. The approximate physical location, so they can keep a presence, help quadrant off the area, and keep people on the outside of the perimeter out of the way. Look for associates of the target, tipping them off, that sort of thing.
How much advance time you figured the locals had in case there was a leak from there?
Hour?
Well, nobody set up that death trap in an hour.
Who was the undercover on this one?
Goes without saying that you take this name to the grave with you.
Bates paused, presumably for emphasis, and then said, His name is Randall Cove,
a real vet, working the target from deep inside. I mean deep, like down in the sewer deep. African-American, built like a truck, and could do the street stuff with the best of them. He's done a million of these gigs.
So what's his story?
I haven't asked him.
Why not?
I can't find him.
Bates paused and then added,
Do you know for certain if Cove was aware when the hit was happening?
Webb was surprised by this question. Your end would know that better than mine. I can tell you for a fact that we were not briefed that the undercover or any snitches would be at the target. If they were supposed to be there, they'd tell us in the pre-op. That way, we'd know who they were, what they looked like, and we'd cuff them and get them out just like everybody else, so the real target wouldn't get a heads up and kill them.
How much did you know about the target?
Druggies financial ops with bean counters present, heavy security. They wanted the money guys as potential witnesses that we were to treat as hostages, bag them fast and get them out before anyone figured out what we were doing and pop them so they couldn't rat. Our strike plan was approved, ops orders written. We got blueprints of the target and built a copy of it at Quantico. Practiced our butts off until we knew every inch. Got our rules of engagement, nothing out of the ordinary, suited up and climbed in the Suburban. End of story.
You guys do your own surveillance, snipers on glass, Bates said, referring to snipers observing the target through binoculars and spotting scopes. Anything pop on that?
Nothing special, or else we would have been told in our briefing. Except for the possible witness angle, to me it was just a glorified dope house raid. Hell, we cut our teeth on those.
If it was just a dope house, they wouldn't have needed you guys to crack it, Webb. WFO could have used its SWAT team.
Well, we were told the logistics were really tricky, and they were. And we knew the targets were supposed to be real nasty and were packing some ordnance SWAT didn't think they could handle. And then you had the issue of the potential witnesses. That was enough to make it our gig. But none of us were expecting 8 remote-controlled miniguns.
Obviously, it was all bullshit, fed to us like mother's milk. Except for the guns, the place was empty. Ambush all the way. There were no bean counters, no records, no nothing.